Former world leaders congratulate Ibrahim Raisi for winning Iran's presidential election as his supporters celebrate his victory. Iran says filling the gap with the other side to reach a deal on the revival of JCPOA is not an easy job. And this is ahead of a new round of talks in Vienna. And the Yemeni army downs an American spy drone over Marib province, where heavy fighting is going on between Ansarullah fighters and Saudi-backed forces. Let's start this bulletin with the latest on Iran's presidential election. Ibrahim Raisi has won Iran's 2021 presidential election by a landslide victory. The cleric has become the eighth Iranian president since its establishment of the Islamic Republic in 1979.
The short but intense presidential race in Iran came to an end on Saturday, with principalist flag bearer Ibrahim Raisi announced as the next president. Out of some 29 million votes cast in the election, Raisi secured more than 17.9 million votes to win the election by a comfortable margin against his reformist rival, Abdel Nasser Hemati, who stood third in the race with less than 2.5 million votes.
Mr. Ibrahim Raisi is chosen by the people as the winner and president with 17,926,345 votes. Mr. Mohsen Rezai Miqat got 3,412,712 votes. Mr. Abdel Nasser Hemati, with 2,427,201 votes, is in the third place. Mr. Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, with 999,718 votes, is in the last place.
President-elect Raisi was the chief of Iran's judiciary from 2019 until he won the election. The Muslim cleric ran with the slogan of popular administration, Strong Iran, with a focus on uprooting corruption in the executive branch, fighting poverty, creating jobs, containing inflation, and housing prices.
I will make changes to the circulars that allow astronomical salaries for certain managers. This way we can help promote justice.
President-elect Raisi will take over power from outgoing President Hassan Rouhani with a host of unresolved issues. On top of them is an economy affected by the U.S. sanctions. That's in large part tied to the fate of the 2015 nuclear deal. On the campaign trail, Raisi stood out as an outspoken critic of Rouhani's policies. He believed that the ultimate cure for the economy must be explored inside the country.
Mr. Raisi comes from the principalist camp, which believes that any talks with the West must take place from a position of a strength, unlike the weak stance adopted by the outgoing administration, which has made the negotiations erosive. Raisi would continue the Vienna talks, but he would tell the other side, hey, if you want a deal, let's have it. If not, we'll continue with our remedial nuclear steps.
Some 60 million Iranians were eligible to vote in this year's election. The Interior Ministry put the final voter turnout at 48.8%. The polls opened an hour earlier at 7 a.m. on Friday, and voting was extended several times until 2 a.m. on Saturday, both to accommodate the flow of voters and prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Ibrahim Raisi has promised to recover the Iranian economy and strengthen it in the face of sanctions. Now it's up to him to make good on his promises and bring about the economic change that every Iranian is now hoping for. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Fireworks light up the skies over several Iranian cities as supporters of President-elect Raisi took to the streets to celebrate his victory. People took to the streets, mosques, and other public places to express their joy at Raisi's landslide win. He garnered nearly 18 million out of a total 29 million votes cast on Election Day, becoming the eighth president of the Islamic Republic. His rival, Mohsen Rezai, came in a distant second with 3.4 million votes, followed by the other two candidates. The president-elect has 4 years to deliver on his campaign pledges, which include fighting poverty and improving the economy. In the meantime, congratulations are pouring in for Ibrahim Raisi on winning Iran's presidential election. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro expressed hope for further boosting of ties and cooperation between Caracas and Tehran. Cuban President Miguel Diaz-Canel has wished success for Raisi in performing his duties. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega also expressed deepest congratulations on behalf of his nation. Leaders of other countries, including Russia, Turkey, Iraq, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, and the UAE, already offered felicitations to the Iranian president-elect. Okay, now let's invite a couple of guests and ask for their opinion regarding this election in Iran. So I'll be joined by Hamid Reza Badamzadeh, who's a foreign policy analyst in Tehran, and Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, is also joining us from London. Good to have you both, gentlemen. Let's go to Hamid Reza first. Let's have your comments on the presidential election in Iran and the outcome.
Thank you very much for having me. You know, this election was very important because we had the election after 8 years, or at least 4 years of difficulties, especially economic problems and difficulties that people were facing. And many people were very disappointed with this current situation, and actually can say current government. The point was that many foreign media outlets or many foreign states were trying to change it or interpret this election as some referendum for the legitimacy of the whole establishment and whole the whole system. And they were actually encouraging people to turn out to this voting state. And they were saying that the turnout would be something around 20-30%. But the point is that of course, this turnout, nearly 50%, is less than the average turnout in Iran in presidential elections. But anyway, it shows that people are still participating in this political procedure. And the point is that the election is not a referendum for the legitimacy of the whole system. People show that they are not going to, let's say, stop voting and stop communicating with the system, and discouragement, this campaign to prevent people from turning from going to the ballot boxes has failed because of the people. To talk about legitimacy of the system and how people are actually aligned with that, one needs to look at national events, like, for example, anniversary of the revolution, that we usually have marches on the streets or a vote day, or at the top of all the commemoration ceremony held for General Soleimani, in which we have all witnessed that tens of millions of people went to the streets across the country to pay tribute to him, who was actually a symbol of a revolutionary figure who supports the Islamic Republic and serves the Islamic Republic, actually. So the connection between the people and the system, the Islamic Republic, can be seen at those places. That's why the foreigners, the enemies, we can say, anyone who was against the Islamic Republic, was trying to actually interpret this election as that referendum, which was correct. The story is totally incorrect and wrong.
So, Mohsen Abbas, how to look at this, and also tell us about the challenges that the president-elect will be facing in his tenure.
Well, I think that, of course, here in the West, when I follow Western media, they clearly have all sorts of reasons why Iran is, you know, defunct as a democratic nation. I mean, they've got an allergy to anything that happens in Iran, which is positive. Having a religious democracy that functions well for this period of time under the kind of stress that Iran has gone through is quite frankly an amazing achievement. It's nothing short of a political economic miracle that Iran is even still standing. So if you look at the propaganda at this end, they allege electoral fraud quite often. It's viewed often as being, this whole business of presidents, even if they come to election, that they're powerless in some way. They'll promote ideas like people's enthusiastic participation as actual electoral engineering. So even if you had a huge turnout, as it usually is in Iran, mega turnouts, really, they'll still have something negative to say. I don't think you need to worry about the way the world views Islamic Iran's democracy. The fact is that is that it's there, it's existing, and they've chosen a president now who I think, let's call a spade a spade. He will be far more in synchronicity with the ideals of the Islamic Revolution and the vision of Rebel, Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Simply, I say this simply because if we look at just one area, which people are very concerned about at the moment in Iran, and the election was fought on this, was the economy. So you've got two kinds of economy that are potentially there for the new president to adopt. One is neoliberal economy, i.e. copying and pasting what Westerners do and how they operate their economic systems, which the results of which ultimately really are just making the rich richer, the poor poorer, and the continuation of the rape and plunder of other weaker nations around the world. This is how Western neoliberal economies function. They function fundamentally on an injustice and unfairness. Now, as an Islamic Republic, Iran cannot operate really such an economic strategy. So I would posit that the new president of Iran will plumb for what I call, or what is known as the resistance economy, one in which Iran focuses far more on domestic production, domestic manufacture, its own raw materials, the better manufacture of those, the lowering of the, if you like, reliance on oil as its main asset to sell abroad, and the diversification, if you like. Also, of course, a stronger move towards, an even stronger move towards the Asia rather than Europe as a set of economic partners. I think that's going to definitely gather pace and strength with China, Russia included as well, and beyond. I think this could also provide an alternative economy. Looking to the West is a dangerous thing economically for any coming president. Bottom line is the West's economies are also going to go through a huge depression. Everything is lined up for that, what with the pandemic, COVID-19, wrecking many, many aspects.
All right, thank you very much for your comments and contribution. Hamid Azad Qalamzad, a foreign policy analyst in Tehran, and Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator in London, joined us with their contributions and comments. Tehran has summoned British ambassador to protest violent incidents targeting its expatriates who showed up at polling stations in the UK to participate in presidential election. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says the violence was perpetrated by anti-revolutionary, anti-democratic, and terrorist elements insulting the voters and Iranian embassy staff. Said Khatibzadeh said that incidents included the beating of a female voter in Birmingham. He said that Iran would launch legal proceedings against those it holds responsible. Iranian media reported several incidents on Friday on the sidelines of the vote organized for Iranian citizens in Britain, the United States, Australia, and elsewhere. Mina Taylor says that adversaries in Iran are trying to undermine and dismantle Iranian democracy by attacking expats who are trying to vote abroad.
Essentially, world organizations, political leaders trying to undermine the democratic process inside Iran, and then by virtue of that, trying to undermine that process when, as in any other nation, you have your embassy and your consulates and special places that allow your citizens to come and enjoy their right and express their preference for a candidate of their choice. when you've already built up an anti-narrative to that, those who are already in the pockets of Iran's enemies will see that as a sign that they're being emboldened and that they would be protected by this. And just specifically, even with our own crews who are covering this event, there were a lot of very vocal members of the ragtag dissident community who were essentially organized. This wasn't just people coming down to a polling station, to an area to express their dissatisfaction with a particular candidate or with a particular system. This was a coordinated setup situation.
Iran says clinching agreement in the Vienna talks to revive the nuclear deal is not an easy job, considering the remaining gaps. Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says the parties are very close to clinching an agreement, but a number of contentious issues remain unresolved. Araghchi, who is in Vienna for the sixth round of talks, says that the negotiating parties are quite close to an agreement. He said, however, that they should make their mind on the outstanding issues. Iran has been calling for the removal of all sanctions reimposed or imposed and or relabeled by the former U.S. administration before the nuclear deal could be revived. Tehran says it's ready to fully return to its relevant commitments once the bans are lifted verifiably. The United States has so far refused to call off the sanctions. The Yemeni army says it shot down an American spy drone over Damara province. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said that the drone, known as Scan Eagle, was spotted and hit while flying over Mashja region in Mara province. The UAV was brought down using a land-to-air missile. The spokesman also underlined that the Yemeni armed forces would not hold back any effort to defend the country's skies against any aggression. The Yemenis have shot down several American spy drones since Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies backed by Washington launched a war on the country in 2015. The war has left tens of thousands of people dead, many of them women and children. And with this, we come to the end of this broadcast.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Leader's speech in meeting with members of Assembly of Experts. This is part of a speech delivered on August 31, 2006 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with members of the Assembly of Experts.
Another important goal is attending to underprivileged and remote areas. These are among our dreams. Besides, one can see that there are open and active minds with scholarly outlooks among the people who work today in the administration and the executive branch. Apart from their work ethics, we can see in official reports and during the meetings that we have with a number of honorable ministers that the behavior is based on reason and scholarly outlooks. and that they do not show negligence in making calculations. In the present time, programs are like this. They are thinking, working, and evaluating different issues. They take action and move forward in a constant and incessant way. This is very valuable. A young, enthusiastic, and fresh group of people have entered the arena and are working very well. I have heard and seen the propaganda that exists against the current positions and orientations. These propaganda efforts are mostly made by our opponents outside the country and those who are opposed to the essence of the Islamic Republic. These things are in front of our eyes. We watch and listen to all the news in this regard, and we know whom the target of this propaganda is and whose minds they want to deceive. The truth is what I said. Good tasks, in the real sense of the word, are being carried out in every area. Well, the result is that a kind of enthusiasm has been generated in the people, particularly youth. The people have the enthusiasm to work and to be hopeful and optimistic about the future. We can understand and feel this from the meetings that we have with the people and from other sources. The same condition exists in the arena of foreign policy. Today, our dynamism and enthusiasm in the area of foreign policy are good. We can see this great dynamism and enthusiasm and these vast activities. On many global issues, particularly on regional issues, the initiative is in the hands of the Islamic Republic. The fact that the initiative is in the hands of the Islamic Republic is an unprecedented and unique phenomenon.
Communicate. Syrians have taken to the polls and re-elected Bashar al-Assad as president of the Syrian Arab Republic for a fourth consecutive term. With an extraordinary turnout rate and landslide victory, the West has actively sought to undermine the election and the will of the Syrian people. So what does this victory mean for Syria's 10-year resistance against regime change and against imperialism? And what tactics have Western nations resorted to in order to discredit and sabotage Syria's presidential elections? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On May 26th, 2021, Syrians took to the polls to vote in the second presidential elections since the start of the war on Syria in 2011. A month earlier, in April, 14 candidates had been approved to run by the People's Assembly. Bashar al-Assad, candidate of the Ba'ath Party, won in a landslide victory of 95.2%. The turnout was an astonishing 78.6%. which is very high under any circumstances, never mind for a country under siege. After the results of the elections were announced on May 27th, Syrians went out to celebrate, taking to the streets in droves. People all over Syria came out to celebrate with scenes of victory in Umayyad Square, in the country's capital, Damascus. Scores of people poured out onto the streets of the port city of Tartus on the Mediterranean Sea, with similar images popping out from all over the nation. With a turnout rate of 78.6%, this is quite a remarkable feat. In European elections, the turnout rate is usually somewhere between 50 and 60%. The turnout rate in the 2020 presidential elections in the US was around a record-breaking 67%. The head of the Syrian parliament, Hamoud Sabah, announced the results of the election with around 14 million Syrians who came out to vote, which, given the situation of so many Syrians displaced by the war and the country still in turmoil, is very impressive. Now, before a single vote was cast, Western nations were already attempting to undermine the Syrian presidential elections. Several of them outright rejected the results in advance and proceeded to call the elections undemocratic. They claimed that the elections were illegitimate because they allegedly left many Syrians excluded. Ironically, these very same countries themselves prevented Syrians living abroad from even voting in the first place. For example, in Canada and Germany, Syrians were prevented from casting ballots at the Syrian consulate. These very same countries who pretend to be liberal democracies then turn around and deny Syrians the right to participate in their own presidential elections and prevent them from exercising their right to vote, which is a pivotal part of any supposed democracy. This claim that Syrians were purposely excluded was not just repeated by Western countries, but also by the opposition and opposition figures, which is all the more ridiculous given that the opposition, they are the ones who boycotted the electoral process, refusing to participate. In the northern city of Idlib, which is home to thousands of foreign-backed terrorists, of course it is not possible to partake in the election. The same rings true for the areas controlled by the American occupation and Kurdish forces in the northeast regions of Hasake and Deir ez-Zor, where they are busy plundering Syria's oil, of course.
We're keeping the oil. We have the oil. The oil is secure. We left troops behind only for the oil.
Now, in the media, the reporting about the elections has been abysmal. We have witnessed a concerted campaign by the corporate mainstream media to smear Syrians and their elections and to openly lie about the will of the Syrian people. Not one mainstream outlet in the West has even had any Syrian officials on to comment about the election, only opposition figures. The media have also resorted to talking about the staged Douma gas attack of 2018. This alleged gas attack was used as a pretext by the United States, Britain, and France to illegally bomb Syria. It was subsequently proven that this gas attack never took place, a false flag operation designed to blame the Syrian government as the Syrian army made its final push to take back the surrounding areas of Ghouta in the Damascus countryside. We have seen through leaked documents published by WikiLeaks that this gas attack never happened. The very same inspectors sent by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, to investigate reported only trace quantities of chlorine, physical symptoms inconsistent with the gas attack, and ballistics showing the alleged gas canister to have been manually placed at the site. The inspectors concluded that given the lack of evidence, no gas attack had materialized and expressed concern after their findings had been removed. The OPCW's leadership doctored the reports of the fact-finding mission, removing key evidence in an attempt to cover up the truth and proceeding to smear its own scientists who blew the whistle. During this latest election in Syria, President Bashar al-Assad went to Douma to cast his ballot. The mainstream media used this photo op as an opportunity to revive the lies surrounding this staged gas attack and to attempt to smear the Syrian government and President al-Assad once more. Right now in Syria, many people are suffering due to the terrible economic situation and havoc brought on by sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union. Universally, in almost every article and television report on the topic of Syrian elections, the mainstream media talks of the economic turmoil that Syrians are living through, without ever mentioning that this suffering, the long breadlines, the wait of almost 2 days just for fuel, is a direct consequence of Western sanctions. The media talk about Syrians living in poverty to illustrate the people's purported dissatisfaction with al-Assad giving the impression that it is the fault of the Syrian government. First of all, this has nothing to do with elections. Second, this is not only untrue, but more importantly, it is a whitewashing of Western crimes. Syrians are suffering and starving right now precisely because of the West's foreign policy and imperialism, yet this is rarely ever mentioned, if at all. If one wants a real example of propaganda, they need look no further than how the Western media reports on all matters related to Syria. It's frankly astonishing how anyone can make a report about the Syrian elections and not mention a simple basic truth, that the majority of Syrians support Bashar al-Assad. If these so-called liberal democracies in Europe and North America care so much about democracy and the will of the people, why do they ignore this fact? It is incredible how not one report or article mentions this. The media call the elections a sham, but they talk about everything else without actually explaining why. They obfuscate and change the subject by mentioning the economic turmoil, but don't tell you that this is the fault of Western sanctions, and they try to make it sound like it's al-Assad's fault or the Syrian government is to blame. They talk about democracy, but don't tell you that the majority of Syrians support al-Assad, nor do they show any of the images of countless Syrians taking to the streets in a show of support and to celebrate his victory. They lie, they deny reality, and deceive to manufacture consent for regime change. That is what you call propaganda. Joining me is former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford. Thank you for your time. It's great having you on the program, Your Excellency.
It's a pleasure.
Ambassador, the British government, along with the Americans and others, they called the elections in Syria, quote-unquote, undemocratic and illegitimate. They've outright rejected the results before the elections even took place. Could you give us an insight into what the motivations behind this are?
In a word, revenge. The Western powers, Britain and America in particular, are bitter because they have failed in their 10-year-long campaign to change the government in Syria. And they are therefore very bitterly disappointed because the recent elections served to underline their failure and to cement the position of President Assad in power. So what we heard was the sound, if I can put it this way, the sound of sour grapes.
So having been posted in Damascus and spent several years there, what do you make of the legislative and the electoral process in Syria?
Well, I don't think there can be any doubt that a majority of the Syrian people do not share the West's wish to get rid of President Assad. On the contrary, the president is seen by, indisputably by a majority of Syrians as representative of stability. They do not, the Syrian people, without a shadow of a doubt, do not want to make a leap into the dark by getting rid of the president that they know. And when there is no alternative in prospect, who could unite the country, take the country forward in the next steps, rather the reverse. I'm quite sure that a majority, an authentic majority of the Syrian people have confidence in their president. They may grumble about the conduct of the government, rising prices, corruption, alleged maladministration, that sort of thing. Which country is free from such grumbling? Certainly not my own, the UK. And indeed, I believe that the level of support for the president is authentically well above the estimated 40% level of support enjoyed in the opinion polls by Boris Johnson and his government. I believe that the Conservatives or Labour would be absolutely over the moon to have the level of support that President Assad has.
When you say that Syrians don't want to take a leap into what is essentially the unknown, what do you think the alternative is? What is the alternative that the West is proposing to President Assad?
The West is always careful not to spell out, alternative, because they know full well that the only realistic alternative would be a radical Islamist regime. They are totally irresponsible in wishing for what they call euphemistically a transition, which is translated means a regime change, but that phrase has had a lot of bad publicity, so they call it transition. They don't ever say transition to what, and there is no Nelson Mandela waiting in the wings in Syria. In fact, most Syrian people could not put a name on any Syrian opposition leader. I would be hard-pressed myself, and I'm a so-called expert. There are no plausible rivals, alternative political leaders to the president. There are warlords. There are warlords who, like such as those who rule the roost in Idlib province, who would undoubtedly, after fighting among themselves, inherit the crown in Damascus if the Western powers had their way.
In the early days of Tony Blair's government, the United Kingdom and other countries, they actually seem to be or appear to be on good terms with President al-Assad. I mean, what do you make of the current stance of the last 10 years from those in British politics and media who insist that Syrians are not deciding their own future and who've done this complete 180?
A lot of things have happened since those heady days the early 2000s, when Bashar al-Assad was having tea with Her Majesty the Queen in Buckingham Palace, and was being seen as the new white hope, and who was moving forward with liberalization of the economy in a way that was applauded in the West, and indeed it was partly those efforts at liberalization by causing some suffering for the working classes in Syria and privileging of the middle class with this so-called liberalization. This was one of the reasons for the discontent which precipitated the uprising. But things have obviously moved on, and what Britain in particular cannot stomach is the fact that Syria has worked more and more closely with Russia and Iran, and therefore victory for Syria, victory for President Assad would be seen as victory for the leadership of Russia and Iran. This is something that the British government cannot stomach. So you have to see relations with Syria in the context of British relations with Russia and Iran. Poor old Syria is just the victim in the middle.
So just to wrap up, just as a last question, Ambassador, what do you think that al-Assad will do during his next term? What will be the next moves, do you think, from all these various governments that are trying to remove him and topple him? How do you see the rest of the war playing out?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think one of the options the president must be looking at is whether to make a move on Idlib, now that his hands are less tied than they were, although this is a difficult moment internationally in one way because of the ongoing negotiations between the United States and Iran over nuclear and sanctions. And I can see some argument for not rocking the boat in Syria before that matter is settled. But in due course, I'm quite convinced that the Syrian government will move to repacify the North East. I can see increasing pressure on the U.S. Presence in Northeast Syria. The tribes of that area, the Arab tribes of that area, are mostly very pro-Assad. They will not tolerate the Kurdish suzerainty which the American forces are imposing on them. But above all, I think the president will have his work cut out to cope with this continuing economic warfare. There is no doubt that it's the Western sanctions which are the biggest obstacle to Syrian reconstruction, and not just reconstruction, but even getting back a normal, ordinary life with availability of fuel and bread. I'm sure that will be the president's number one priority.
Ambassador Peter Ford, thank you so much for your time, Your Excellency. I'm very grateful for you coming on the program.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
The countries that have rejected the election results in Syria, dubbing the elections undemocratic, they have been trying to push an agenda and topple the Syrian government now for over 10 years. They have no genuine interest in the will of the Syrian people. They are most concerned with enacting their foreign policy objectives in ensuring profits for their multinational corporations and in expanding their empires. This notion of calling foreign leaders illegitimate or calling elections undemocratic is a tactic often used by the West when talking about countries that they have an imperialist agenda in. We have seen the United States, Britain, and the European Union do the same thing with the Venezuela's presidential elections and its parliamentary elections, which we covered in late 2020 on this program. We have seen the West do the exact same to Evo Morales in Bolivia in late 2019 when he was overthrown by right-wing groups supported by the West. And in the case of Venezuela, this notion of legitimacy has also been used by the Bank of England as a ruse to steal over $1 billion in gold belonging to the Venezuelan people. The West loves to pretend that it has the moral high ground. They speak about Syria, Venezuela, and others as if they are colonies under their rule. This is a colonial mindset. Who are these countries to talk about rejecting the results of the Syrian elections? The results of the Syrian elections are for the Syrian people to decide, and Syrians only, not some men in Whitehall, Washington, D.C., or Paris. I find it incredible that the United States has the gall to lecture other countries about democracy when its own citizens are disenfranchised from voting. African Americans are still treated like second-class citizens, and Native Americans completely removed from any political capacity, wiped out through centuries of genocide. How can the United Kingdom lecture anyone about democracy when its judiciary is controlled by the United States, when it gives immunity to American spies who kill British citizens, or when Julian Assange is rotting away in Belmarsh prison for exposing the war crimes of the U.S. empire? Where is the respect for an independent press and fourth estate? The United States and Britain together have colonized and plundered the world for centuries. To this day, they continue to overthrow the democratically elected governments of Latin America, Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. They are the last people on earth to be giving lectures about democracy. The fact of the matter is, there has been a cold, calculated attempt to overthrow the Syrian government for decades. We know from General Wesley Clark that a neocon plan for regime change has been put in place during the Bush years, with Syria on the list of targets. We have seen the cables from the U.S. Embassy in Damascus already in 2006 about how best to exploit the weaknesses of Bashar al-Assad in order to destabilize Syria. The United States created al-Qaeda during the Cold War. then with Britain, proceeded to help create ISIS through the invasion of Iraq in 2003. With their allies, such as Israel and Turkey, they have provided weapons, logistics, and assistance to terrorist groups inside Syria. And then the media tries to whitewash them as moderate rebels. Since the start of the so-called Arab Spring or uprising in 2011, they have been trying to topple the Syrian government and turn the whole country into another failed puppet state, as they have done to so many others. Through their imperialist greed, they have completely, utterly destroyed Syria. These actors do not have Syria's best interests at heart, nor do they care about the will of the Syrian people. Quite the opposite. What Syrians have done through these elections is reaffirm their sovereignty, cementing their stance against imperialism and against colonialism. The election results are not just a victory for President Assad, they are a victory for the Syrian people. Syrians have shown their resolve and their spirit to be unbreakable. Even after 10 years of war and all the suffering that has come with it, they have been unrelenting. Once again, they are showing the world that they will not allow others to dictate their political, economic, and social affairs. Syrians will not allow foreign-backed terrorists and militias, nor any other governments, to come in and tell them how to run their country. Syrians want a secular, stable Syria under Bashar al-Assad, which stands with the axis of resistance, which stands with Palestinians, which stands against imperialism, and guarantees a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, harmonious and peaceful society for all Syrians. No matter what the media says, no matter how much propaganda they produce and how much they try to sell regime change, Syrians are saying they will not be coerced or bullied into conforming to Western foreign policy objectives. Syrian matters are for Syrians only to decide. If President Bashar al-Assad did not have the support of the Syrian people, he could never have remained in power and withstood 10 years of war against him, and withstood 10 years of the United States, Britain, and Israel, and so many other countries and their terrorist groups trying to get rid of him. No one could. It's unconscionable to think that anyone could survive such a feat without the backing of their own people. Syrians have shown that they support their president and their government, both during wartime and in their elections. For anyone to deny this is simply to deny reality. It's not about one's opinion or what one thinks. This is about understanding the truth on the ground. We also have to look at this election through the lens of resistance. What Syrians do every day, what they have done for years, is resist imperialism through all means necessary. This huge turnout and landslide victory also symbolizes a victory for the axis of resistance as a whole. When we talk about the axis of resistance, we're talking about the nations that the West has tried to break and intimidate, such as Syria, Iran, Palestine, Venezuela, Cuba, Yemen, Lebanon, Iraq, North Korea. We have seen during this vicious war against Syria how the whole world rallied behind the U.S. empire and joined them in their regime change project. Very few stood by Syria's side and remained with the Syrian people. Iran and Russia have helped Syria to stay afloat and to resist this onslaught. When Syria was in its darkest hour and on the verge of falling into the hands of Daesh, they answered the call to aid. They stepped in to provide and help to prevent the unthinkable from happening. They have stood steadfast with the Syrian people, respecting their will and protecting their sovereignty from foreign aggression, both militarily and politically. The entire apparatus of the mainstream media continues to repeat the same lies about Syria in a multitude of languages and mediums. There is complete uniformity and hegemony between the corporate media and the foreign policy objectives of Western governments. Inextricably intertwined, these two institutions work in tandem, and everything they have reported on Syria for the last 10 years has been almost entirely propaganda, and the presidential elections of 2021 are no different. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss issues and questions regarding the Islamic upbringing of our children, because our children are our future. And to help us with our issues, we have Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi with us, the always blissful Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for being with us.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Okay, so Sayyid Abdullah, we began the last episode talking about the methods related to the upbringing of our children. We're trying to have a positive upbringing. That is the keyword of our show. And up to now, we've talked about accepting that this is our responsibility. It's not someone else's job. And secondly, understanding that the best method is to fix ourselves in order so that our children can be better reflections, much better reflections of ourselves. We explained that, so we have a first step and the foundations, that is us. And so what we're trying to do now is that for them to become much better than us. And last episode, we talked about finding out our problems and issues and mistakes and trying to fix them. But what about the good things that we have? Like, some people might be very good at smiling or might be very honest and things like that. Would it be inappropriate for someone to go after the good things about themselves and try to also transfer that to their children? I mean, would it be against humbleness?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد وعجل فرجهم. Okay, just so we make a few things clear, that we're trying to go through the process of making a better child, right? So we haven't gone through the methods yet. So now we're talking pretty much about the intro to the methods. So this is the prerequisites to the methods. So inshallah, we'll talk about the methods one by one and what we can apply. So just keep that in mind.
We'll talk about all of this extensively.
Yeah, so inshallah we'll talk about them, but just so you can have that, because sometimes we keep mentioning the word methods, but we actually have not spoken about the methods yet, right? Okay. So all this talk, if we try to clear the way, clear the path, so inshallah we could get to the methods one by one that parents could apply in their life and to their kids' upbringing. So when we said that a parent needs to get rid of the negative and have the positive things, when it's a matter of teaching, all the concept of, you know, show off and ria and everything falls off. I mean, these things, like, for example, like what you said, if you do it to the outside world, to people just to show off, obviously we have a problem, right? That self-showing off is a problem, or ria is a problem. But if you're doing it, for example, smiling, like you mentioned smiling, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he said, at-tabassumu sadaqa, right? Smiling is a charity. Even if you don't feel like smiling, even if you don't want to smile, smile for free. It's a charity itself, right? So teach yourself that habit. Not just saying, okay, I'm going to smile just to show off, to do riya. No one would do that. You know what I mean?
I'm thinking of that, like, person think that I'm now going to raise this muscle.
So it doesn't go against being humble and stuff like that. No, it's actually on the contrary. When you nice things on the outside, it becomes a habit that you do always. And it's a good habit, you know what I mean? So it's not going to collide with the concept of riya, or the concept of, you know, being humble and so on and so forth. It's not going to clash. But when it comes with our kids, like I said, we have to put up even a show just so they could learn from us.
Okay, great. I think that's a great place to stop. A golden sentence. Sometimes we have to put up a show just to teach our children something. We're going to take a break now, but after the break, we'll be back to continue about the prerequisites of a positive upbringing. Don't go away.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about a positive upbringing of our children. So Sayyid Abdullah, we said that there are a few prerequisites. The first one is accepting responsibility, that this is our job to raise this child. The second is to fix our own problems in order to raise our children correctly. We cannot expect them not to inherit our problems, or for us to keep our, like, for instance, if we're this chronic liar, for them not to turn into chronic liars as well. What is the third prerequisite in a positive upbringing?
The third one we have to mention and end with, so we can move on, because I think the more we keep talking, the more we drift away from the topic, is that the parents need to understand that their child forms a shape and it gets sculptured into a human being around the first 8 years of his life. So 90%, they say, according to psychologists, 90% of who the child is when he grows up is made in the first 8 years. So imagine if you have mud and you're trying to make a sculpture, or you make a figure out of mud. This is the years that you put the shapes in. And if you notice that most of the problems that adults suffer from, like when it comes to their morals, when it comes to their upbringing, when it comes to their ethics, what they lack, if you go to the source of it, you'll find that when they were in the first 8 years, something went wrong. That shows up back. So, for example, when you look at, talking statistically here, so for example, when they look at people who are thieves, those who steal, or rapists, or murderers, they say, well, most of the times when they were kids, they either lived in a violent family, or either they lived in a family where, for example, one of the parents is not available, either they're orphaned or, you know, through divorce. All things went wrong in that period of their life, that it just made such a trauma into them that as they grew older, they just don't care anymore. So they would steal, they would kill, they would rape, they would do all crimes. So it all goes back to what? To these first 8 years. So as parents, we have to put a great emphasis in this, you know, first 8 years of their life. We have to take that extremely seriously, because sometimes we do the absolutely opposite. We say, you know what, they're just kids, leave them. No. So in a hadith from Imam Sadiq salamullah alayhi, which we use as a golden rule when it comes to upbringing, it says, "Atrukuhum sab'an, adubuhum sab'an, sahabuhum sab'an," right? So leave them 4/7, tease them 4/7, and befriend them 7. So when we say leave them 4/7, we're not saying just let them be whatever they want.
Abandon them.
It say teach them, but teaching, what kind of teaching? So the Imam says first 7 years, there's no teaching. The second 7 is a teaching process. In the first 7, what we do is we bring them up and we teach them through example. Like, we embed the good akhlaq, the good morals, the good ethics into them without enforcing it as in a teaching way. And the other 7, no, I sit the child down, I say to him, this is halal, this is haram, this is you should do, this is you should not do. So it becomes more of an enforce. But that becomes what? I have to give you an example. For example, we say girls need to wear a hijab at the age of 9. So what we do is, like, 2 years before, we make her wear the hijab. Just, you know, out of habit, so we don't enforce it.
Mm-hmm.
We say, you know, wear it, it's nice, it's good, you know, we encourage her. But that's, it's not a teaching. After 9, we say, no, darling, you have to wear it.
Becomes strict.
You have to wear it. And we teach her why you have to wear it. You know what I mean? So the first 8 years is vital in programming the child.
Okay. I'm going to have to stop you there for a late break, but we'll be back. Don't go away.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, when a child becomes intellectually mature and is able to recite parts of the Quran, he should be taught how to pray.